The hot dog at the game beats roast beef at the Ritz. Well, that's baseball, and it's my game. You know, you take your worries to the park and you leave them there. You yell like crazy for your guys. Could be your lungs. Gives you a lift and nobody calls the cops. Pretty girls, lots of them. But none any prettier than baby. Are you listening, baby?
It's that golden moment.
Hey, pick them up, guys! Pick them up!
The preliminaries have all happened, the warm-ups, the national anthem. Someone famous or not so famous, a local hero, a fireman, a film star, a politician, throws out a ceremonial first ball. The catcher, squatting, scoops it up. Vendors are tossing bags of peanuts and popcorn through the rows. And neighbours who've become pals for the afternoon hand over the dollars. Thousands of Boston rear ends settle in their red seats. There's a happy buzz around Fenway Park.
I love the crooning that goes on at ballparks. It's perfect. Makes you feel that Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams might be coming out the back. Even though Sinatra is a Yankees icon, you know, he's shared by everybody.
And though you can't hear it above all that top quality singing, the home plate umpire does that thing that sets it off, spikes the adrenaline, shouts, "Play ball!" And the hometown pitcher, 60 feet and 6 inches exactly from the batter, does his thing. He leans in a bit to see the catcher stick 2 fingers of each hand down between his squatting thighs and wiggle them around a bit. It's a sign. It tells the pitcher what kind of ball to throw, and the pitcher either shakes him off in disagreement or raises himself slowly. It always seems to me so mighty slow. He lifts one leg, chest high, pivots on the other, and then down comes the arm, and something shoots out of his hand at upwards of 90 miles an hour. And then the glorious, complicated plot gets underway. Maybe too complicated for some people. Here's comedian Bob Newhart.
You got 9 guys on each side. Yeah. And you got a pitcher and a catcher. And they throw this ball back and forth. And that's all there is to it? All right. A guy from the other side stands between them with a bat. I see. And he just watches them? Oh, I see. He swings at it. He may or he may not swing at it. Depending on what?
If it looked like it were a ball. What's a ball, Mr. Doubleday? As long as it's above the knees, but below the shoulders. Yeah. No, go ahead, I'm listening. Yeah. It's a strike. 3 strikes and you're out, and 3 balls. Not 3 balls, 4 balls. Why 4 balls, Mr. Double? Nobody's ever asked you before.
But for Roger Angel, the dean of baseball writers, the game's no joke, but often a terrifying trial.
I did a piece about hitting called One Hard Way to Make a Living, and I talked to a lot of hitters, and I said, are you ever afraid about this? They said, no, they're not afraid. And then one of the people I talked to was Hawk Harrelson, who later became a manager, now he's a broadcaster of the White Sox. And I said, are you afraid? And he said, of course I'm afraid. And I said, you're the only person who said I'm afraid? He said, of course I'm afraid. They were all terrified up there. And they wouldn't own up to it. This is the only sport where great stars, everybody fails out in public. Hitting a pitch is such a difficult act of coordination. Think
yes,
about
I've tried
this.
It.
I mean, the pitch is coming in here at around 90, 92 miles an hour. But you have to react, and you have to react and hit the ball on the nose. Yeah. And the difficulty of baseball shows itself all the time. This is, I think, why it is different from other sports. It is so hard, even for the best teams, to win. The best team in baseball wins 2 out of 3 games. And the worst team in baseball wins 1 out of 3. So that's 1 game out of every 3 that makes the difference.
That last home run, Hank was going some when he hit the last home run.
Fear of failure is an odd, gloomy, primal instinct to drive a sport. But that's the reason why former pitcher for the New York Mets, Derek O'Coin, thinks baseball has serious lessons to teach young kids at his baseball academy, something bigger about life.
We just use baseball as a medium to convey the attributes of self-esteem and confidence and being able to overcome obstacles and, more importantly, being able to bounce back really quick. Because baseball is the only sport, is the only game where you can fail over 70% of the time and be an all-star. So baseball, it teaches a lot of how to overcome adversities and not to let the little things bring you down. And we start that at this age here.
And as in life, you have to take what's thrown at you.
There's an old saying that says that hitting is timing and pitching is upsetting timing. Any typical major league pitcher will probably have at least 4 pitches in his repertoire. The most popular pitch is the 4-seam fastball. It's a fastball that you hold with the seams. When you release it, it has tremendous backspin. An average Major League Baseball pitcher can probably throw this ball 92 miles an hour.
So I've just seen Rivera, absolutely. He's someone who pitches the last inning at upwards of 90 miles an hour, and they are, whoa. Maybe you can hear just that extraordinary kind of clap sound. And what Rivera's doing is just getting faster and faster. He's actually working up to his true pitching speed, which is something absolutely awesome to behold. I have to say, you really don't want to be, I wouldn't want to be a hitter watching that coming at me, actually.
And here's the really weird part. What is the pitcher aiming at? Answer, nothing. Thin air, no solid object, no wicket, no stumps, just something called the strike zone. An invisible space drawn by the umpire between the batter's knees and his shoulders. If the pitcher gets the ball there and a batter doesn't make contact, either by a wild swing or just letting it go past, it's a strike. 3 of those and you're out. Ed Smith, the author of Playing Hardball, is one of those rare birds who's played both cricket and baseball professionally. And he thinks that baseball is one tough game to master.
My experience with baseball as a player, I mean, when I wrote Playing Hardball, which was about a year following the Mets and some of the time being with the Mets at spring training, I think it's very hard for cricketers to properly adapt to baseball. And I think a very good pitcher would make a fool of pretty much any cricketing batsman. And that, I think everyone who's tried that, from Marcus Truscothick to, you know, Ian Botham, has found it very difficult.
But get the pitching wrong and the game falls right away from you. We've started the game at Fenway here and already things are getting pretty tense.
Yeah, now the jam has just got more serious because he's issued 2 walks in a row. We have 2 Yankees on base, only 1 out. Psychologically, during this inning, the advantage goes massively towards the Yankees. The pitcher has to really keep cool. This is could be the turning point of the game, very easily.
It's often said, and rightly, that baseball is as much an expression of American national character as cricket is all about being English. But in some ways, it makes you think again about what that national character really is.
One of the interesting things about American sport is in the land of the free, the land of opportunity, the land of second chance. Everything's passed down from on high, like in some platonic system of truth. No one makes a decision in American sport. The coach makes all the decisions. So there's a chain of command that goes from manager to catcher to pitcher, and he just sits there and does what he's told to do. And if he overrules, my God, you know, all hell's let loose. When I was a young player in cricket, as a 12th man, I was about 18 or 19, I was sent a message out by the coach, tell the captain to do this and tell him it's from me. And the captain on the field replied, F off and tell him it's from me. As well, in American sport, there's this structure and hierarchy. And in baseball, people are following instructions, not so much with the bat, but with the pitching.
Guess what? It turns out that this reverence for the pecking order of command and the obsession with scoring statistics is all the work of the British. If you ask most people in America who think they know about the subject, who was it who invented baseball, they'll say Abner Doubleday, a Civil War general in the middle of the 19th century. That's why the Baseball Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown in upstate New York, where Doubleday lived. But guess what? It's all a fairy tale, a myth, a lie, invented so that baseball would not seem something dreamed up by the Brits, but something purely native, sprouted instead on good American soil. But it turns out Abner Doubleday never saw, much less played, a game in his life. And up there in Cooperstown, in the Hall of Fame, is the man who really was baseball's father, Henry Chadwick of Exeter. Born in 1824, emigrated at the age of 12 to Brooklyn, New York, but who never forgot his English roots, nor the rounders he'd played as a child. In 1868, he recalled,
"Between 30 and 40 years ago, my favourite field game was the old schoolboy sport of rounders. Of course, the game was merely a source of fun and exercise, but little skill being required to play it, any schoolboy being able to learn it in 10 minutes. But from this little English acorn of rounders has the giant American oak of baseball grown."
The big surprise about the person who codified the rules of baseball and the box scoring system was that he's English. He was born in Exeter, Henry Chadwick, and he really is the one who draws together the disparate threads of the emerging baseball system in America. Of course, the first, well, perhaps the first baseball team was the Knickerbocker Club in New York. So there are different games going on. There are different sort of streams flowing into this emerging river. And Chadwick draws it all together and says, right, if we're going to have a game called baseball, this is what it should look like. And he gives it a structure and he gives it a tautness, which it had previously lacked.
So, yes, you've got a little history here. Well, you didn't think I'd let you get away without it, did you? But this Henry Chadwick wasn't a nobody. He was the half-brother of one of the great Victorians, Edwin Chadwick, the emperor of city sanitation, engineer, layer of pipes, terminator of the plague of cholera. They were an inventive lot, the Chadwicks, and wouldn't you know, it was Henry Chadwick, the transplanted Englishman, who had the notion that if America wanted to make it clear it wasn't just another England on the other side of the ocean, it had better have its own game, just as it had its own way of speaking, writing, politics, singing.
It was in 1856, I think, when, on returning from the early close of a cricket match on Fox Hill, I chanced to go through the Elysian Fields during the progress of a contest between the noted Eagle and Gotham clubs. The game was being played sharply on both sides. It was not long before I was struck with the idea that baseball was just the game for a national sport for Americans. And, thanks to baseball, we have been transformed into quite another people. From being content to play second fiddle to the sportsmen and athletes of England, we shall not rest content until we have defeated them in every specialty of games of which they have for so many years been the leading exemplars.
The preacher is Chadwick, an Englishman, But the person who sells the message is Spalding, the American entrepreneur, who finds a way to make money out of baseball being American. And he takes, in 1888, a world tour of his baseball team, which is actually a bit of a flop. People don't really like it around the world. But they come back and they have a dinner. I think it was in New York. And they all chant, "No rounders, no rounders, no rounders." And they set up the commission to discover that the origins of baseball were Abner Doubleday, and we all know that's complete nonsense, in 1839 in Cooperstown, these kind of things. So you have this myth of the Immaculate Conception, and then Spalding markets baseball. He markets it as a way of being patriotic. Don't be effete. Don't play cricket like those Anglophile sissies in the Knickerbocker Club in New York and along the Eastern Seaboard. Do what's real, do what's manly, do what's American, and play baseball. And all of a sudden, you've got the interrelationship between national myth and money-making.
But for a tantalising few years, at the turn of the 20th century, there was baseball in England. Why did the footballers of Derby County play in the baseball ground? Because they once played ball there. And not just there, but in Stoke, in Birmingham, in Aston Villa. There once was a moment where my very own North London team, Spurs, Tottenham Hotspur, meant baseball players. And the same went for Fulham, Arsenal, Chelsea, West Ham. Baseball was supposed to be the summer game that would keep footballers fit, since, of course, the toffs who ran cricket weren't interested.
American baseball was very well marketed through the press, through the sporting news, and through an emerging newspaper market as well. And it fits in with the technological advances of late 19th century America. Baseball coming to England, you have the opposite problem, where the sort of governing bodies of English sport have never been businesses first. They've been private clubs first, the LTA, the MCC, so on and so forth. And the idea that baseball would come as a fully-fledged business into our rather anti-business, anti-commercial sporting world was a huge affront.
So hands across the sea never got to play ball. It was easier in Britain to make cricket the imperial game and leave the American farm boys with their tow hair and chewing tobacco to their ballpark playtime. And maybe it suited America better as well. What the United States wanted as it plunged into the American century was a sense of itself, its uniqueness in the world, and baseball gave it that. By the time it became serious moneyball, baseball was a way, perhaps the way, of becoming American. Immigrant kids played it as stickball in the back alleys of teeming, hard-nosed cities like St. Louis and Chicago, Detroit, and of course Boston. Roger Angel, who started watching the game in the 1930s, is the living memory of baseball history.
One of them talked about traveling around in Nebraska, I think. They had a team that traveled around in a couple of hay wagons, and they would go from town to town and sleep out at night in tents and eat apples out of the orchards. And when they came to a town, they'd have a bugle, and they'd take on the town team. People came from that background to a major league team. Baseball became a country game played in big cities, and all these ballparks were played in them right in the heart of downtown cities, which gave their strange angular shape. They fitted them into a grid of streets, which is why Fenway has the shape it has, and represented that town, Pittsburgh or Boston or Philadelphia or Chicago. But the players, without exception, were country boys.
And there used to be a ballpark where the field was warm and green.
The early Red Sox rosters are, for me, a long poem of American names. Some of them from the farms, some from the mean streets. Rabbit Warsteer, Windy McGee, Beanie and Baby Doll Jacobson, Stuffy McGinnis, Nemo Lelbold, Turkey Gross, Pumpsy Green.
Yes, there used to be a ballpark right here.
There's a lot of misty-eyed clapdoodle romance about the beautiful game, of course. The grass wasn't the only green stuff casting its spell. It was always hard business deals, some of them shady. Players traded like horses, bribes offered to throw games. One great player, Shoeless Joe Jackson of Chicago, never recovered from a bribery scandal. For generations, his team was unable to wash the stain out, so the White Sox became known as the Black Sox. Bittersweet troubadour of American life, Tom Waits caught the dark side of baseball sentimentality. With a song sung by a washed-up boozer to a union of equally ruined veterans.
And we toast to the old days and DiMaggio too. And old Drysdale and Madu, Whitey Ford and two.
Well, that's pure poetry in a Rye on the Rocks way. And more than football, more than cricket, baseball has always walked hand in hand with literature.
Oh, you know, you're ganging around. Everyone has left town, except for Thumb and John.
Two things about literature and sport. The first one is the small ball theory, that the writing about sport gets better as the ball decreases in size. So there are no great books about beach volleyball, but there are lots of great books about cricket
golf.
And baseball and golf.
Like, yeah. Golf, yeah.
And the other thing is that in terms of writing and literature, I wonder whether both sports, cricket and baseball, offer, was it Michael Billington's phrase about Harold Pinto, finding poetry in everyday speech, that even in quite a dull, you talk about both sports having longueurs, really, some quite boring moments in cricket and baseball, aren't there? Even within a dull passage of play, something very beautiful will happen. A perfect shot, a perfect bit of fielding, an interesting duel within a non-interesting, bigger duel. Yeah. And that means that there's something for the discerning fan almost every time. I think you can. I remember once I turned on the television and in America and you see a double play and you think, I'm going to turn off now perfectly satisfied, in the same way that you turn on and watch an exquisite late cut in cricket and just turn off again and say, oh,
yeah, it can't get better.
Can't get better than that. I'm going to stop now.
I couldn't agree more. Between the water cooler in the kitchen and the public relations office, here's literature. Red Sox actually attracts writers. And here was a writer who's passionate about it, John Updike. And here is John Updike at his most extravagant best. Fenway Park, he says. Fenway Park in Boston is a lyric little bandbox of a ballpark. Everything is painted green and seems in curiously sharp focus, like the inside of an old-fashioned peeping-type Easter egg. It was built in 1912 and rebuilt in 1934 and offers, as do most Boston artifacts, a compromise between man's Euclidean determinations and nature's beguiling irregularities. Only with the Red Sox, actually, would the word Euclidean conceivably come to mind.
But baseball in Boston has not just been fancy writing. Not so long ago, it was notorious as a racist town that toyed with a great African-American baseball player, Jackie Robinson, by pretending to give him a tryout. Well, that was decades ago. Jackie Robinson really did break the colour bar with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and now the game is truly multiracial, truly international.
Well, my father born in 1889 when he grew up, but he played baseball. And played baseball in his youth, and everybody did. I mean, he went to college and became a lawyer, but he was still playing baseball in his 30s. Even in my youth, that wasn't happening. So baseball draws from a very different, much wider world area now. I mean, two-thirds going on toward a half the players now are Latin American. And there's a contingent from Japan and others from Korea, and there are players from Australia. And the major leagues now play on opening days of the first series in Japan. The idea that we're going to have an international World Series is probably not... It'll happen, I think, in the next 10 years or so.
That's why the ace of the Red Sox pitching today is called Daisuke Matsuzaka.
This is the crucial pitch of the inning. He's got one of the Yankee batters, Jason Giambi, to two strikes. They're two on. This is where the kind of crowd starts to get into it, clapping. They know it's the crucial pitch of the game.
I guess the rhythm of baseball is like the rhythm of our beating heart. Long stretches of ho-hum where not a lot happens, the pulse just ticks along. But then suddenly, it's the seventh or eighth inning and you thought you had a big lead, and then someone makes a terrible error in the field, bobbles a ball or gets dazzled in the lights and misses and lets runs score over home plate, and you're on the razor's edge, caught between terror and hysterical joy.
So they've dug themselves into another hole. Crowd's getting, not ugly, but it's very unhappy. It's not happy. What was it? Roger Angel talked about fear. You can see it out there. You can smell it. You can taste it.
I've seen the mighty rise to the occasion and then be crushed by misfortune. Such a fine line between the two. But I've already got half life's worth of memories of great players who people the history of the game. And I've got high on the ordinary beauties of baseball that are its stock in trade. A perfectly executed double play with the ball fired from shortstop to second to first. A thing of such delicate fury, it's hard to explain how great it sounds. But I'm here for the duration, not just the high drama. I've lived through games that seem like years they became so dull and then, without warning, got so thrilling. I've lived through games that were cakewalks and became high wire acts. Games that were in the bag and then weren't. Games that were impossible to win and then were won. What's that you say? Sounds a bit like life? Well, yeah, only much. Much more so. And whatever else they play at my memorial service, I'll rise from the tomb if they forget this one.
Hey, take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 'Cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old...
Simon Sharma was presenting Baseball and Me. The reader was Peter Marinka and the producer was Philip Sellers.